Chapter 64. Come powerfully upon me. Long, long ago, money necessity furnished that impulse once, following the equator, but mere desire for money has never furnished it, so far as I remember. Not even money necessity was able to overcome me on a couple of occasions, when perhaps I ought to have allowed it to succeed. While I was a bankrupt and in debt, two offers were made me for weekly literary contributions, to continue during a year, and they would have made a debtless man of me, but I declined them, with my wife's full approval, for I had known of no instance where a man had pumped himself out once a week, and failed to run dyings before the year was finished. As to that Ozark book, I began it in Edinburgh in 1873. This is not quite correct. The Ozark book was begun in Buffalo in 1870. I don't know where the manuscript is now. It was a diary, which professed to be the work of Shem, but wasn't. I began it again several months ago, but only for recreation. I hadn't any intention of carrying it to a finish or even to the end of the first chapter, in fact. As to the book whose action takes place in heaven, that was a small thing, Apton Stormfield's visit to heaven. It lay in my pigeon-holes 40 years, then I took it out, and printed it in Harper's Monthly last year. S50. See, in the next letter we get a pretty, and peaceful picture of Estonby-thankful. These were Mark Twain's palmy days. The financial drain of the type machine was heavy, but not yet exhausting, and the prospect of vast returns from it seemed to grow brighter each day. His publishing business, though less profitable, was still prosperous. His family life was ideal. How gratefully, then, he could enter into the peace of that perfect day. To Mrs. Orion Clemens, in Keokuk, Iowa. On the hill near Elmira, July 10, 87. Dear Molly, this is a superb Sunday for weather, very cloudy, and the thermometer as low as 65. The city in the valley is purple with shade, a scene from up here at the study. The cranes are reading and loafing in the canvas-curtained summer house 50 yards away on the highest point. The cats are loafing over at Lursley, which is the children's estate and dwelling house in their own private grounds by deed from Susie Crane, 100 yards from the study, amongst the clover and young oaks and willows. Livy is down at the house, but I shall now go and bring her up to the cranes, to help us occupy the lounges and hammocks whence a great panorama of distant hill and valley and city is seeable. The children have gone on a lark through the neighboring hills and woods. It is a perfect day indeed. With love to you all. Sam. 2 days after this letter was written, we get a hint of what was the beginning of business trouble, that is to say, of the failing health of Charles 50. Webster. Webster was ambitious, nervous, and not robust. He had overworked, and was paying the penalty. His trouble was neurasthenia, and he was presently obliged to retire altogether from the business. The M and Mary mentioned were Samuel Moffat and his wife. To Mrs. Pamela Moffat, in Fredonia, N.Y., Elmira, July 12, 87. My dear sister, I had no idea that Charlie's case was so serious. I knew it was bad, and persistent, but I was not aware of the full size of the matter. I have just been writing to a friend in Hartford who treated what I imagine was a similar case surgically last fall, and produced a permanent cure. If this is a like case, Charlie must go to him. If relief fails there, he must take the required rest, whether the business can stand it or not. It is most pleasant to hear such prosperous accounts of Sam and Mary. I do not see how Sam could well be more advantageously fixed. He can grow up with that paper, and achieve a successful life. It is not all holiday here with Susie and Clara this time. They have to put in some little time every day on their studies. John thinks she is studying too, but I don't know what it is unless it is the horses. She spends the day under their heels, in the stables, and that is but a continuation of her Hartford system of culture. With love from us all to you all. Affectionately, Sam. Mark Twain had a few books that he read regularly every year or two. Among these were Pepys' diary, Suetonius's Lives of the 12 Caesars, and Thomas Carlyle's French Revolution. He had a passion for history, biography, and personal memoirs of any sort. In his early life he had cared very little for poetry, but along in the middle 80s he somehow acquired a taste for Browning, and became absorbed in it. A Browning club assembled as often as once a week at the Clemens home in Hartford, to listen to his readings of the master. He was an impressive reader, and he carefully prepared himself for these occasions, indicating by graduated underscorings the exact values he wished to give to words and phrases. Those were memorable gatherings, and they must have continued through at least two winters. It is one of the puzzling phases of Mark Twain's character that, notwithstanding his passion for direct and lucid expression, he should have found pleasure in the poems of Robert Browning. To W.D. Howells, in Boston. Elmira, August 22, 87. My dear Howells, how stunning are the changes which age makes in a man while he sleeps. When I finished Carlyle's French Revolution in 1871, I was a Girondin. Every time I have read it since, I have read it differently, being influenced and changed, little by little, by life and environment and Taine and Saint Simon. And now I lay the book down once more, and recognize that I am a Sansculot. And not a pale characterless Sansculot, but a merit. Carlyle teaches no such gospel, so the changes in me in my vision of the evidences. People pretend that the Bible means the same to them at 50, that it did at all former milestones in their journey. I wonder how they can lie so. It comes of practice, no doubt. They would not say that of Dickens or Scott's books. Nothing remains the same. When a man goes back to look at the house of his childhood, it has always shrunk. There is no instance of such a house being as big as the picture in memory and imagination call for. Shrunk how? Why, to its correct dimensions. The house hasn't altered. This is the first time it has been in focus. Well, that's loss. To have house and Bible shrink so, under the disillusioning corrected angle, is lost for a moment. But there are compensations. You tilt the tube skyward, and bring planets and comets and corona flames 150,000 miles high into the field. Which I see you have done, and found Tolstoy. I haven't got him in focus yet, but I've got Browning. Is ever Mark. Mention has been made already of Mark Twain's tendency to absentmindedness. He was always forgetting engagements, or getting them wrong. Once he hurried to an afternoon party, and finding the mistress of the house alone, sat down and talked to her comfortably for an hour or two, not remembering his errand at all. It was only when he reached home that he learned that the party had taken place the week before. It was always dangerous for him to make engagements, and he never seemed to profit by sorrowful experience. We, however, may profit now by one of his amusing apologies. To Mrs. Grover Cleveland, in Washington. Hartford, November 6, 1887. My dear madam, I do not know how it is in the White House, but in this house of ours, whenever the minor half of the administration tries to run itself without the help of the major half, it gets aground. Last night when I was offered the opportunity to assist you in the throwing open the Warner Brothers' superb benefaction in Bridgeport to those fortunate women, I naturally appreciated the honor done me, and promptly seized my chance. I had an engagement, but the circumstances washed it out of my mind. If I had only laid the matter before the major half of the administration on the spot, there would have been no blunder, but I never thought of that. So when I did lay it before her, later, I realized once more that it will not do for the literary fraction of a combination to try to manage affairs which properly belong in the office of the business bulk of it. I suppose the president often acts just like that. Goes and makes an impossible promise, and you never find it out until it is next to impossible to break it up and set things straight again. Well, that is just our way. Exactly one half of the administration always busy getting the family into trouble, and the other half busy getting it out again. And so we do seem to be all pretty much alike, after all. The fact is, I had forgotten that we were to have a dinner party on that Bridgeport date. I thought it was the next day. Which is a good deal of an improvement for me, because I am more used to being behind a day or two than ahead. But that is just the difference between one end of this kind of an administration, and the other end of it. As you have noticed, yourself, the other end does not forget these things. Just so with a funeral, if it is the man's funeral, he is most always there, of course, but that is no credit to him. He wouldn't be there if you depended on him to remember about it. Whereas, if on the other hand, but I seem to have got off from my line of argument somehow. Never mind about the funeral. Of course I am not meaning to say anything against funerals, that is, as occasions, mere occasions, for as diversions I don't think they amount to much, but as I was saying, if you are not busy I will look back and see what it was I was saying. I don't seem to find the place, but anyway she was as sorry as ever anybody could be that I could not go to Bridgeport, but there was no help for it. And I have been not only sorry, but very sincerely ashamed of having made an engagement to go without first making sure that I could keep it, and I do not know how to apologize enough for my heedless breach of good manners. With the sincerest respect, S. 50. Clemens. Samuel Clemens was one of the very few authors to copyright a book in England before the enactment of the International Copyright Law. As early as 1872 he copyrighted Roughing It in England, and piratical publishers there respected his rights. Finally, in 1887, the Inland Revenue Office assessed him with income tax, which he very willingly paid, instructing his London publishers, Chatto and Windus, to pay on the full amount he had received from them. But when the receipt for his taxes came it was nearly a yard square with due postage of considerable amount. Then he wrote to Mr. Chatto, of Chatto and Windus, in London. Hartford, December 5, 87. My dear Chatto, look here, I don't mind paying the tax, but don't you let the Inland Revenue Office send me any more receipts for it, for the postage is something perfectly demoralizing. If they feel obliged to print a receipt on a horse blanket, why don't they hire a ship and send it over at their own expense? Wasn't it good that they caught me out with an old book instead of a new one? The tax on a new book would bankrupt a body. It was my purpose to go to England next May and stay the rest of the year, but I found that tax office out just in time. My new book would issue in March, and they would tax the sale in both countries. Come, we must get up a compromise somehow. You go and work in on the good side of those revenue people, and get them to take the profits, and give me the tax. Then I will come over, and we will divide the swag, and have a good time. I wish you to thank Mr. Christmas for me, but we won't resist. The country that allows me copyright has a right to tax me. Sincerely yours, S. 50. Clemens. Another English tax assessment came that year, based on the report that it was understood that he was going to become an English resident, and had leased Buckingham Hall, Norwich, for a year. Clemens wrote his publishers, I will explain that all that about Buckingham Hall was an English newspaper's mistake. I was not in England, and if I had been I wouldn't have been at Buckingham Hall, anyway, but at Buckingham Palace, or I would have endeavored to find out the reason why. Clemens made literature out of this tax experience. He wrote an open letter to Her Majesty Queen Victoria. Such a letter has no place in this collection. It was published in the Roar of Harper's Magazine, December, 1887, and is now included in the uniform edition of his works under the title of Petition to the Queen of England. From the following letter, written at the end of the year, we gather that the typesetter costs were beginning to make a difference in the Clemens economies. To Mrs. Moffat, in Fredonia. Hartford, December 1887. Dear Pamela, will you take this $15 and buy some candy or some other trifle for yourself and Sam and his wife to remember that we remember you? Bye. If we weren't a little crowded this year by the typesetter, I'd send a check large enough to buy a family Bible or some other useful thing like that. However, we go on, but the typesetter goes on forever at $3,000 a month, which is much more satisfactory than was the case the first 17 months, when the bill only averaged $2,000 and promised to take 1,000 years. We'll be through now, in 3 or 4 months, I reckon, and then the strain will let up, and we can breathe freely once more, whether success ensues or failure. Even with a typesetter on hand, we ought not to be in the least scrimped, but it would take a long letter to explain why and who is to blame. All the family send love to all of you, and best Christmas wishes for your prosperity. Affectionately, Sam. XXVIII Letters, 1888. A Yale degree. Work on the Yankee. On interviewing, etc. Mark Twain received his first college degree when he was made Master of Arts by Yale in June, 1888. Editor of the Courant, Charles H. Clark, was selected to notify him of his new title. Clark was an old friend to whom Clemens could write familiarly. To Charles H. Clark, in Hartford. Elmira, July 2, 88. My dear Charles, thanks for your thanks, and for your initiation intentions. I shall be ready for you. I feel mighty proud of that degree. In fact, I could squeeze the truth a little closer and say vain of it. And why shouldn't I be? I am the only literary animal of my particular subspecies who has ever been given a degree by any college in any age of the world, as far as I know. Sincerely yours, S50. Clemens M. A. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.